Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here today with John Madai. He is the author of the book Towards a Truly Free Market, A Distributist Perspective. John Madai, it is great having you on.
Robert, it's great to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Hey, and Robert, you forgot me.
I'm also joined with my co-host, Charles Lincoln.
Well, John Madai, it's a great honor to meet you finally. How's life in Dallas?
Well, it's very good, except for that it's pretty bloody hot.
Well, I'm temporarily here in Los Angeles, and it's astoundingly hot here. It's hotter here than it was all summer in New Orleans, so I'm kind of surprised I came.
Now, what qualifies as hot in Los Angeles?
It is in the 90s. How is it in Santa Barbara, Robert?
Maybe between 75 and 80.
Oh, okay. So you're in California, but Los Angeles has moved into Arizona, basically.
Apparently.
Yeah, it's bad. Are you a native Dallasite, Dr. Madai?
No, I'm a native of New York City, as a matter of fact, but I've lived here since about 1970.
Well, I've been reading up on you, and it's very interesting. You know Louise Cowan, apparently?
I do indeed, yes. She was one of my teachers. So.
Oh, so you went to graduate school at Dallas?
And undergraduate school as well. I came to Dallas to go to UD, yes.
Amazing. Okay, because no, my mother and grandmother were good friends with Louise Cowan, and I was asking my mother today if she had heard of you, but she hasn't. She said she's been out of touch with University of Dallas crowd for quite a while. But you have an interesting perspective then, being in a I take it you're a Catholic.
Yes.
Right. And yet you've lived your whole life in this very radically Protestant town. How has that worked out?
Well, I don't think it's a big deal anymore. Dallas used to be the buckle on the Bible Belt.
Very much, yeah.
But I think it's there's been a large influx of Yankees, so it's not the same anymore. The city, now the surrounding area is still very much retains that Texas quality, but not so much, and Fort Worth does, but not so much Dallas, I think.
Did you happen to know the Dr. W.A. Criswell of First Baptist Church?
I do not. I know of him, of course.
Okay. Well, anyhow, I think it must be fascinating because you know that in 1960, there was a huge controversy about, I guess 10 years before you got there, about whether Dallas was going to break the solid South because they didn't want to vote for a Catholic and the Democratic ticket, and it was every bone that LBJ could break to make sure that Texas went Democrat.
And Lyndon could break a few bones, that's for sure. But now it's changed. Dallas is more of a Democratic county now than a Republican. Matter of fact, I think a lot of the county offices are in Democratic hands right now. So obviously there's been some big changes.
Since we're starting on this topic of Texas, I want to kind of get your thoughts on this because a lot of conservatives have touted Texas as this economic miracle, and they talk about how Texas is creating all these jobs and economic opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's partially true, but you have to factor in the fact that we're an oil state, and we were in an oil boom. We had that going for us. I don't think that's true anymore, and in fact, the jobs we're creating are pretty low-level, Walmart, fast-food-type jobs. So it's I think aside from the oil boom, it may have been more hype than anything else.
In preparation for this chat, I was reading your Schizophrenia at the Heart of the American Political Order, and directly related to Robert's question, I noticed your comment, indeed it may well be the case that an American conservatism is a practical impossibility, and from the standpoint of both the University of Dallas and Dallas, Texas in general, I think that was a very interesting thing to say. And do you think that Texas is a fundamentally conservative place?
Well, see, that depends on what you mean by conservative. Texas is conservative in the sense that we have a large rural population. We have a large population that's still related to the soil, that's still related to the small town. We have populations of old Central Europeans that have maintained their, you know, at least some connection to their culture. We have towns in Central Texas that are Czech, and in other towns that are, you know, trace their roots back to Germany or to Bohemia. And what people don't know, as a matter of fact, the average cowboy in the heyday of the cowboy, was more likely to be Middle European than anything else, and have names that the English might consider odd. So in that sense, I think Texas is very, very conservative in the old sense of the term. But conservatism in America has come to mean no more than economic liberalism. So you have this tremendous confusion between the terms conservative and liberal. So when they say Texas is conservative, what they mean is that from the standpoint of even 50 years, 70 years ago, Texas is hyper-liberal. And that introduces a certain note of confusion into the political dialogue.
Now, you say that you're from originally from New York. Robert, let me just follow up on this one, and I'll let you go. But you say you're originally from New York, and so what is your perspective on the relative northern and southern and Texan triangulation on the meaning of conservative? I mean, do you see any traces at all in your Dallas of sort of the hierarchy that was characterized, the social hierarchy that was characteristic of the Old South?
In Dallas, no. The hierarchies now are all of wealth and money. And Dallas is a financial city. I mean, our elites are mainly in the financial business. I guess some are in the oil business, I think, but that's mainly Houston. I think our elites are basically financial elites. No, I don't see any connection between the old Southern aristocracy and Dallas. Dallas is a very artificial city. It doesn't have, like, Fort Worth was cattle. Houston was oil. You know, Dallas didn't have a natural advantage. It's not on a great trade route. It sort of created itself in the cotton trade, as I understand, in that sort of commercial enterprise, and then later in banking. So it's somewhat more artificial than other Texas cities.
So your book is titled Towards a Truly Free Market. What is your definition of what a truly free market is, and how is free market capitalism not a free market?
That's an excellent question. I used to give my students an exercise of looking up, taking any economics textbook and looking up three terms: property, freedom, and free markets, and going to the index and finding the definition of these terms. And it turns out none of these three terms in nearly every single economics textbook, they're not defined. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So when you talk about a free market, my criteria for a free market is the number of barriers to entry. How many people can easily enter or exit that market? And the infallible sign of a free market is a high degree of competition. If your products are made, you have a choice in the same product of a wide variety of suppliers, then it's undoubtedly a free market. Now, what we have under capitalism and free market is not the same thing. In fact, they're enemies. So in free markets, in capitalistic markets, things tend to consolidate. However, they do give the appearance of competition. So if you go into the grocery store, you see 30, 40, 50, 100 brands of cereal, and you find out they're all two companies. You go into the beer section and you find 50, 75, 100 brands of beer, and that's impressive until you find out that 80 to 90% of the beer market is controlled by two companies, InBev of Belgium and the South African Brewing Company. And across almost every market sector, you see the same thing. You see capitalist consolidation, which is the mortal enemy of free markets.
So how do we get to a truly free market that you're advocating? Basically, what you're saying is that the problem with capitalism is that there's too few capitalists. The goal is to have as many people competing with each other as possible. What kind of policies can we put forth that will implement that?
Yes. Well, one, the government has to, I think, our tax codes, subsidies, high levels of subsidies that always privilege the big over the small, things like this have to end. We can take a lighter tax burden on smaller businesses, a lighter regulatory load on smaller businesses, and concentrate regulation it's really more necessary in larger businesses. And so policies like that encourage smaller enterprises and sort of level the playing field. You have to understand, perhaps the biggest subsidy to big business is the thing that Americans have come to accept as sort of a natural right, and that is the highly subsidized transportation system. The trucking does not pay anywhere near the costs of the public infrastructure for transportation. Hence, trucking, even though it's far less efficient than rail, since rail pays almost all of its own costs, trucking appears to be cheaper because it doesn't pay for the roadbed. If you put weight and distance tolls on the highways, so the heavier trucks pay more and pay more per mile, the whole Walmart distribution scheme is revealed to be the total inefficient scheme that it actually is. And the whole Walmart paradigm, the whole big box store paradigm breaks down. And I think you see a resurgence of small retailers and small manufacturers.
Would it be necessary to implement antitrust laws or just basically enforce existing antitrust laws?
I think that goes a long way. Since the 80s, they've either watered down or simply not enforced antitrust laws. One area now where that's becoming really important or really visible to the public is in control of the airwaves. So fewer and fewer choices on cell phones. The networks are increasingly owned by just a few companies. So even when you see different companies, they're actually using the same network. So some of these things where you can buy a SIM card and put in your thing, the ones you can buy at Walmart, they're actually AT&T, or maybe they're actually the Verizon network or something like that. So there's less competition in that area. And consequently, we pay more for Internet and for cell phones than just about any country, any industrial country in the world.
Do you think that what happened perhaps in 1980 when they broke up AT&T was kind of a portent of what was to come? Because it was basically exactly that. They were basically saying, we need the appearance of competition, even though we're going to maintain one single system. Because they basically, what they did was they broke it up into, they broke AT&T up into the baby bells, the regional small clones, basically. But there was no technological difference. There was really no functional difference between Bell South and any of the other companies. It's all about the appearance of. Would you agree that it's all about the appearance of competition in the modern sphere of things?
The appearance of competition is exactly what it's about. As I mentioned, the example of beers or cereals or eye care for that matter. You know, there's 25. You can list 25 different manufacturers of frames, and you can list Pearle Vision and VisionWorks and Sears Optical and Walmart Optical. And they all turn out, they're all owned by Luxottica of Italy. So it's the appearance of competition without the reality of competition. The phone company was interesting because it just so happened at the time of that breakup, I was working for a company called GTE of happy memory. And GTE was the second largest phone company. The structure of the phone company at that time was that the really cheap call to make in terms of cost was a long-distance call. All of the expense was in the last mile. But what AT&T system had done is made long-distance calling expensive and used that to subsidize the local service. Otherwise, local service would have been too expensive for most people. So it was a brilliant strategy. And one can argue that it was probably only obtainable in a monopoly situation, which AT&T basically was a monopoly, at least on certainly in the big and medium cities. So when they broke it up, really you just had... You really didn't have competition. You just had regional monopolies, but you didn't have competition in any sense of the term.
Where so, in terms of the,
you
that
did
was,
begin
that was
to
one
get
of the
competition
last.
Was long distance because that was cheap. Anybody could enter the market.
But that was you mentioned you and Robert mentioned the functionality of the antitrust laws, and that was one of the last really big breakups. Under the antitrust laws, and as you say, it wasn't really much of a breakup at all. At the same time, I don't know if you remember, in the 1970s, Texas had a very strong anti-monopoly policy where they would not allow national banks to do business in Texas,
right.
And that has gone quite the other way in the past 30, 40 years.
Well,
and what do you think about the appear? What do you think? What would you say about the appearance of competition in the banking industry?
Yeah, see, that is that relates back to your other question about whether Texas is still conservative. Now, that national and international banking bias was very, very much a conservative mind frame. And so it was Texas conservatism that kept the banks local. But then this conservatism got redefined to be globalism, to be corporate capitalism. Conservatism got redefined to be its own opposite. And with that, Texas remained nominally conservative, but actually hyper-liberal, and brought in, and then it opened up its banking to the whole ideas of globalism and national banking systems. And so we lost that whole local flavor of our banks.
And
so that relates to another...
With the banking issue, hold on a second. With the banking issue, when we had that financial collapse in 2009, that would have been a perfect opportunity to break up the banks. And then we had the bailouts, but breaking up the banks and having as many smaller banks as possible, that's a key issue. I mean, even Bernie Sanders has been talking about that on his platform.
Yes, the collapse of 2008. Yes, it would have been the perfect opportunity to get rid of the too big to fail banks, which turned out to be the too big to jail banks, and there should have been a lot of prosecutions after that failure. But instead, what has happened, the bailout, instead of doing what they should have done, which is, one, bailing out the borrowers and not the bankers, and two, breaking up Citibank and all the giant banks, and creating strong regional banking systems in place of a New York-dominated banking system, they didn't do that. And so what's going to happen is, well, we're back in the same situation right now that we were in 2007, 2008. And I think we're going to see another derivatives-driven collapse here next year, certainly no later than 2017. So we're going to see a repeat of the same thing. I was talking to a bankruptcy attorney last night, as a matter of fact, and he was telling me, you know, how the derivatives, these risky derivatives caused this mess in the first place. And he says now it's bigger than ever, and they're converting into derivatives things like late fees. You can buy an MBS, a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation, on late fees. That's an incredible market for derivatives. and it encourages the banks to charge as much as they can in late fees and pump up the value of these derivatives.
Well, you've got to have that money multiplier factor going at all times in order to maintain inflation. And that sort of relates to another question I wanted to ask you, given your overall you sort of have a what I would call a perspective of the long durée about the relationship between classical liberalism and modern conservatism, and mm-hmm. I wonder if you have a similar view of the relationship between communism and globalism and this fake appearance of competition that we have. Because do you think that there is a single plan involved in the repeat of the derivative phenomenon, and do you see it as a covert but ideologically driven program of any kind? And if so, what? And I'd like to see if you sort of see things the way I do before I tell you how I see them.
Yeah, I really can't say that I do. I just see more of a dangerous ideology at work.
What is that ideology?
Well, the ideology of money, and it just is an incompetent ideology. I think you're referring to something specific, and I'm not aware of it. So maybe it'd be better if you tell me what you had in mind, because I'm not sure I have an overarching conspiratorial theory on that, other than just the general greed and power of the bankers.
Robert and I on other occasions have talked to Ellen Brown, and I wonder what you...
Oh, Ellen,
what
yeah,
your
no,
food.
Ellen. Yeah, no, Ellen, yeah.
And anyhow, I mean, I think that we're interested in exploring all different aspects of this general problem, but I wonder if the derivative program is not really an articulation of the original Communist Manifesto proposal that the best way to abolish private property in real estate was through heavily leveraged high-interest extensions of credit made as liberally as possible and as often as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really can't comment on that as it being part of a Communist Manifesto. I'm not really aware of that connection. I am aware of a sort of process, not that the not, I don't know that the communists have documented, but the Georgists have documented between land speculation and money, the expansion of the money supply, and which is in fact what we saw in the 2008 collapse. But the I don't know if you're familiar with the Georgists or not, but Henry George's theories on land rent, which derived more or less from both Smith and Ricardo, since land is a fixed quantity, you can't expand the amount of land by any significant amount. You could fill in some swamps or something like that, but you can't expand the amount of land. So as population increases, land goes up. So land is always a naturally speculative market. You buy it, and so long as the population increases, it's going to increase in value. So you have always have a speculative market in land, but speculation fuels booms, which overshoot the mark, and then the price deflates for a while, but it still eventually goes back up. But while it's inflating and loans are taken out on it, and, you know, the supply of money is actually the supply of credit. The supply of money expands with the supply of loans. So right. The banks create money to fuel credit. Now, of course, the expert on that, all of that, is not me. That would be Ellen Brown. The aforementioned Ellen Brown would be the one who would talk to on that.
Well, but it seems like
she knows more than
Brown.
I've forgotten. She's forgotten more than I ever knew.
But you and Ellen appear to agree on one thing, is that you both think that money is artificial and that it should be controlled by basically politically governed banks, which would acknowledge that they're just issuing credit. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a factual statement. I don't think there's actually much to dispute over that statement. That is that you can read straight out of the Chicago Fed manual. And as a matter of fact, you can read it straight out of Aristotle, because Aristotle realized that's what money was. So it's, shall we say, not a novel view. Yeah.
That's interesting, because I mean, I noticed you mentioned Aristotle several times, and I've been following sort of Aristotelians and Platonists recently as they debate the future of the world. And so you think that you believe that money is fundamentally not related to commodities and should not be. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on what you mean. I don't think money is a commodity like gold or anything like that. It's related to credit, and credit in a sensible system, the expansion of credit is related to the expansion of commodities. But it doesn't have to be, because you can also expand credit for speculative purposes, which doesn't add to the amount of commodities, the amount of goods or services available. If you're lending money for speculation or even consumer credit, you're expanding the money supply without expanding the supply of goods and services.
You were interested in the relationship between social justice and the economy, right?
Exactly, yes.
And you believe that social justice is fundamentally a philosophical, religious concept, because you're actually in the Department of Theology, is that correct?
I am. But, you see, I don't make a division between the ethics and economics. That is, morality is a practical science. You cannot, if you take the most basic economic formula, supply and demand, it depends for its proper functioning on a proper division of rewards between suppliers and demanders. That is, the balance of supply and demand is itself a function of the level of justice in the society. So here's the thing. If suppliers don't get enough to at least replace their capital, there'll be a shortage of supply. But if demanders, that is, for the most part, wage earners, don't get enough, there'll be a failure of demand. So its equilibrium is just what it says, a balance. you have to have a balance between the rewards given to suppliers and the rewards given to demanders. And so in that sense, justice emerges as primarily a practical concern. If you don't have justice, you can't economically balance supply and demand. Well, what happens when you don't have justice? Well, you balance supply and demand through two other ways. One, through consumer lending. That is, the people who are getting too much lend some of it to the people who don't get enough, and you keep up demand that way. But the second way is you interpose the government as consumer of last resort. So the government becomes the balancing number between supply and demand. And you get huge deficits as the government tries to absorb all the excess goods and services that the economy is capable of producing. So that's why we have big deficits. If we didn't have these big deficits, we'd have big recessions. If you didn't have government as the consumer of last resort, then the economy just, you wouldn't be able to clear the markets. So
what are your
without justice, you get big government.
What are your thoughts on the concept of wealth redistribution? And a lot of people hear the word distributism, they think redistribution of wealth. Do you support some kind of wealth redistribution? And what type of tax policy would you support? Do you support a progressive income tax?
Yeah, well, insofar as you have as you depend on income taxes, they have to be progressive. Income taxes are not ideal. Ideally, you would do away with income taxes and have just wealth taxes.
Can you explain exactly what a wealth tax is?
Well, my house is wealth, but it's not income. I guess there's an imputed income in foregone rent, but it's not in itself. Wealth, of course, is the economically its most important aspect is the means of production. When you have consolidation in the means of production, you basically have control of society by whoever controls those means of production. So there you want to use all means possible to encourage that wealth to be broken up and to be spread from the international level to the national, from the national to the regional level, and down to actual individual owners. So you want to encourage things like cooperative enterprises. You want to encourage antitrust laws that don't let a few companies dominate markets, things like that. So, and in some cases, and I have here in mind cases where it worked very well, Taiwan, Japan, and Korea, you actually break up large estates and redistribute them to the farmers who actually do the work on them. So,
well, that's sort of classic redistributive communistic policy, isn't it?
Communists
never redistributed estates. That's the exact opposite of communism.
So if you compare the two countries in communist China or in the Soviet Union, the government just came in and took over everything. A lot of people see Taiwan as a capitalist success story, but that what happened originally, Taiwan was a feudalist backwater, and they broke up the land and they gave it to individual citizens. So was this right after the communist revolution, when the anti-communists in China fled to Taiwan?
Yeah, this began in about 1950, late 49-50. They began to break up the estates and distribute them among the workers. Now, they gave the owners not the market value of the land. They gave them a fixed value based on its last few harvests. So they gave them 2.5 times what the land produced in harvest. So if a piece of property produced $1,000 in produce, then they gave the owner $2,500 for it, which would have been well below its market level. What happened is that about 500,000 families in Taiwan got land of their own. And now these people had been sharecroppers paying 50% of the harvest to the landlord. They got to buy the land at that reduced market price, that reduced price, on 10-year terms. So instead of paying 50% to the landowner, they paid 25% for 10 years and nothing thereafter. They just owned it. When they owned the land, the farmers got tremendously creative. I mean, if there's no point in improving the land if the landowner gets all the benefit. But when the land is yours, they improved their farming tremendously. They went to multiple crops per year. They went to higher value but more labor-intensive crops. And so all of a sudden, these 500,000 families had lots of money to spend, and they had never had money to spend. This money to spend fueled a vast consumer boom in Taiwan. At the same time, the former owners, well, they say they were paid 2.5 times. They actually weren't paid anything. They actually got industrial bonds. And these light industrial bonds could have no value outside of Taiwan. They could only be invested in businesses in Taiwan. So you had all of a sudden a tremendous number of consumers suddenly, but you didn't have much industry. So you had these old owners were scrambling to establish businesses to sell stuff to these farmers who all of a sudden had money. And so you see how the boom it created was then self-sustaining. The old owners had a little money to invest. The old peasants had a lot of money to spend. And Taiwan, in one generation, went from a feudal backwater to an industrial powerhouse that was, frankly, kicking American ass, and they did it in one generation. It was a truly remarkable success story based on redistribution of land.
But it was still based in the beginning on a fiat confiscation, which I guess looks a lot more like what did happen in communist countries or, say, in Mexico. And how would you compare that to, say, what happened in Mexico with the breakup of the haciendas and creation of the ejidos?
Well, I can't exactly talk about the Mexican case. I can talk about other similar cases where for example, the classic case is Zimbabwe. They just stole the land from the whites, the descendants of the white settlers, and gave them mostly to government cronies. So you really didn't have any redistribution. You just had a change in the skin color of the landlord.
And landlords who the new landlords had very little interest in producing anything, as far as I can tell.
Yes, exactly. Because they
were a rape and pillage elite rather than anything else.
Exactly. So the thing was, now there was some more than legitimate arguments for breaking up the white estates. After all, the white estates used to be African land. But this was just pure theft. The difference is that in Taiwan, they recognized that the big landowners, while they may not have had the rights they claimed, they at least did have some rights which the state was bound to respect. So they got 2.5 times the harvest for their land. This was able to convert them into urban capitalists. That didn't happen in places like Zimbabwe and many other places. Basically, it was just land theft. Furthermore,
is there any other example of a system where it worked? Is there any other than Taiwan?
Both Korea and Japan did exact. Matter of fact, it was the same program implemented by the same man in all three places.
Who was that man? Because I don't know the story.
Was it MacArthur?
It was under the direction of MacArthur, and I'm having a senior moment. The man had a, it was a Polish name, and for some reason right now I cannot recall his name, but he managed the program in all three countries.
Well, that's interesting, because, I mean, I was thinking that I was trying to see how this reconciled at all with the history of the kulaks in Ukraine and southern and rural Russia.
Yeah, it's not the same thing at all. It was just taking the land from the people and putting it in vast collectives, not in private ownership. So in Taiwan, Korea, Japan, it took it from the landlords but gave it to the actual peasants who were working the land. It was theirs. They had the deed to it, just like you have the deed to your house. Okay? In Ukraine and in Russia, they just abolished private ownership and forced people onto these collectives. So it was not, I mean, it was the opposite of it. It wasn't the breakup of estates. It was actually creating larger estates, but this time, you know, actually one big estate owned by the Communist Party, the Communist government. So it wasn't a breakup. It was a consolidation of estates.
And now I guess, would you say that in the United States right now, we are headed more towards consolidation than breakup through the banking system? Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I'll tell you a story which illustrates this. When I was in college in the 1970s, me and a few of my friends, we worked for Irving Office Supply, Dusty Rhodes proprietor. And, you know, Dusty was a true redneck, God bless his soul. And so we were smart-ass college kids, so we had a lot of fun at Dusty's expense. But what we didn't realize at the time, being callow young men, is that Dusty was a free man. He had his own business. He contributed to the community. He was part of the social fabric of the city. He could always be relied on for a contribution to the high school band or to the hospital. You know? Well, now Dusty's grandchildren have no place in society. The best they can hope to be is store managers for Staples. And Staples doesn't contribute anything to the local community. So it's this. There used to be tens of thousands of people like Dusty supplying office supplies. Okay? Their position has been wiped out of society. They were free men. There's no longer a place for those men. So it's all consolidated now into Staples and Office Depot. You know, it's basically an oligopoly.
What policies were implemented by the government that, on behalf of corporate lobbying, that have put a lot of these small businesses out of business?
Yeah, well, one, the transportation system.
I was going to say that seems like that's one of the key points you made earlier, that I hadn't really thought of it that way. That is very interesting, that by subsidizing the trucking industry, they were able to really support the creation of mega stores, which have their own sort of appearance of communism about them, but go on.
They are, yeah. They're collectives. They're just corporate collectives rather than government collectives. But they are government-supported collectives.
Yep.
But there's any number of tax policies, labor policies. A big corporation like Staples can get a much lower rate of taxation than a place like Rhodes Office Supply. And of course, they can force down both the price and the quality of products. Because the transportation system is so subsidized, it doesn't make any sense to make low-value goods in China, transport them halfway around the world on a ship, put them on a truck, and then transport them halfway across the United States. To say that that's economically efficient is totally nonsense. It's only the vast network of subsidies and the fact that the Chinese currency is manipulated that makes that scheme possible in the first place. But from a standpoint of pure, if you properly accounted for the cost, there is no way that could be efficient. And I think in the future, as road networks begin to deteriorate and as the government becomes less and less able to maintain itself, I think the businesses in the next generation that have the shortest supply lines will have an advantage. The company that can source its as much work as possibly locally rather than having to transport goods, low-value goods, halfway around the planet, those companies will be shown to be inefficient and unable to compete.
The issue of trade is extremely important because when in the past smaller businesses were able to get their supplies locally, free trade agreements made it, they basically were largely responsible for shifting our economy in favor of these large multinational corporations. They could shift the jobs overseas and then import cheap goods, and that basically wiped out a lot of small businesses. Basically, that's really how Walmart got started.
Right. Walmart advertised made in USA, but in fact, their products were in fact for the most part imported. And Walmart itself served as sort of the a branch of the Chinese trade ministries. Here's the way it worked. You're a small manufacturer, Stark Enterprises, and you make widgets, and you need Walmart's shelf space in order to stay in business. So Walmart calls you down into one of their little offices in Bentonville, and they tell you, here's what the price you will make this product at, here's what you will sell it to us at, here's how you will package it, here's how you will accept returns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you say, I can't possibly meet those conditions. They will then hand you a business card for a firm in China that is will meet those conditions exactly and tell you, just outsource all your work to this company and you can meet our conditions. So Bentonville, Arkansas, was a branch office for the Chinese Trade Ministry. And that's the way the system worked. And any company that tried to buck the system, such as Rubbermaid, Walmart just took them off the shelf, and without that Walmart space, they couldn't survive. And they just went bankrupt. So, yeah, that's how it worked.
And another aspect of that, of course, is that the technology of local production and the skills that would be needed to start local production, those have pretty much vanished from the local landscape. I mean, how would people even start locally producing anymore if it became economically feasible?
Oh, I think it's almost the opposite. One of the reasons for the growth of large-scale capitalism in the first place was the tremendous cost, the tremendous capital cost of machinery, because machineries were big, they were heavy, and they were expensive, and so you needed to make 1 million units to pay for the capital costs. Now, there were almost no unit costs, but all the costs were up front in capital, but each additional unit was practically nothing. So you had to sell millions and millions of things, in which case you needed wider and wider markets in order to make that pay. This is no longer true. Capital costs have gone down by several orders of magnitude, machine costs. And so, as a matter of fact, that's part of the thing behind globalization, is that you can move a factory that used to be, you know, $100 million, you can recreate it in Bangladesh for $1 million. So you can spread production around the globe and then have all of these little undercapitalized factories compete against each other. So in a sense, big business has decided on distributism itself. That is, it has distributed its production around the world. But the other side of that, and then they rely just on patents and legal control and control of the distribution channels to keep all the little manufacturers in line. Well, I think that system is breaking down. And I think now you can get, I mean, the numerically controlled CNC equipment, you know, for $5,000. You can get milling machines they're just cheap. They're practically at home handyman prices. And so small-scale production is once more, I think, competitive. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more of small-scale production, and we'll be seeing a lot more businesses come on shore and a lot more localization of markets. And so
we'll
kind of
get... Do you see any signs of that actually happening?
Pardon?
Any examples of that actually happening?
Oh, yeah. Well, in a sense, Tesla is an example of that. They're, and here you're talking about large-scale manufacturing of a very complex product, and it's onshore. Mondragon is an example of that. You have, about 250 or 300 cooperatives, many of them making highly complex products, and they have about 80,000 worker owners spread among these 250 cooperatives, and doing, I think, something in the order of like $25 billion a year in business. You have in northern Italy, you have the Emilia-Romagna system, where you have about 5,000 or 6,000 firms, all of them very small, but they bid on big contracts because they use a kind of network system in which these small firms get together to bid on one contract. So you might have one collection of firms bid on one contract, and then for another contract, you know, there'll be a different collection of firms. And so all of it, you know, basically small-scale production, but combining to compete with large-scale production. So, yeah, we are seeing that model growing. And I think as the problems of capitalism and as the costs of government increase, I think, and as frankly, I'm sad to say, as the problems of the system increase, I think you'll be seeing a lot more regions, a lot more cities, a lot more localities starting to rely on their own resources and to start cutting loose from the globalist system.
With the issue of healthcare, which I think you do have a chapter on in your book, healthcare
mm-hmm.
costs and health insurance have continued to get more and more expensive, and
mm-hmm.
People are pointing to different solutions. On one side, people coming out for a single-payer healthcare. There's people talking about Obamacare. There's people saying that we just need to get government out of the way. What are some of your solutions to having affordable and accessible healthcare?
Well, to take that last one first, you can't get government out of the way unless you're willing to do away with patents and licenses. So government controls the market, or the market is controlled, not government doesn't control it, but it's controlled through government-granted licenses, either the MD, the patent, and the certificate of need for hospitals. This restricts supply. So whenever you have a restricted supply situation, you don't have a free market situation. And when you restrict competition, you're going to get prices continually rising.
This may be opening a can of worms too large for the present hour, but what do you think of abolishing the system of licensing?
Yeah, well, that's a question I address in my book, as a matter of fact. The problem with abolishing licenses is that the consumer has no basis to make a judgment We didn't have licensing for a long time. We didn't have licensing until the 20th century. And,
right.
Let's just say we had tremendous problems in the medical system because you could be a doctor, study 2 years at a local for-profit college run by the local physicians, and after that you could hang up a sign as your two-year basically associate of arts degree in medicine and become a doctor. And you've never touched a microscope. You've never touched a cadaver. You have no idea of pharmacology or anything like that. And so you have basically an incompetent medical system. But at the same time, government licensing has the effect of that it can be controlled and the licensing can be limited to limit the market. So what I proposed in the book is that you still had licenses, but they were granted by guilds, guilds of doctors. So a guild of doctors could say, okay, Robert Stark, you can be a licensed doctor, member of our guild. So what's the control on that? The control on that is you have to admit them to your insurance pool. So if the guild is going to say Robert Stark is qualified to be a doctor, they're going to be real careful about saying that, because if Robert killed somebody, the patient doesn't sue Robert, he sues the guild. And so the guild is going to be real careful about who they admit to their practice. So today in the insurance, everybody's put in the same damn pool. So the competent and the quack are all in the same pool.
Right, so the guild system would have certain advantages, you're saying.
Exactly. It would control, they could allow anybody in, they have complete authority to let anybody into their guild, but they have to stand surety for him. If he messes up, they have to bear the expense through their insurance.
Isn't that interesting? Because that would get rid of the whole notion of sovereign immunity in regard to protecting professions, wouldn't it?
I didn't know that do professions have sovereign immunity?
The licensing boards do.
Oh, the licensing boards. Yes. I see what you mean. Yes, okay. No, and they're just the opposite. The licensing board in this case would be responsible.
I think that's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah. They could grant licenses for different things. So instead of everybody, you know, instead of spending half your youth and all your fortune to become a doctor, there can be different stages. So there can be midwives, there can be nurse practitioners, there can be medical practitioners, medical doctors, and medical specialists. So you can have different levels of service because you don't actually need all of that training to be the first contact, point of contact. A nurse or nurse practitioner can provide those first-line services, perhaps under the supervision of a doctor, but certainly they can do a lot more. So you expand the supply of medical services, and now competition between the guilds controls the market.
And basically there would be no one who would license the creation of guilds, so the only issue about the creation of guilds would be whether they can actually fund themselves or not.
Okay, originally the way insurance was intended was a group of people would pool their resources together in case of an emergency, but the problem is insurance has gotten insanely expensive if you look at the insane amount of profits. I mean, even one issue that could be brought up is states have monopolies on insurance. You can't get insurance from another state, and I know even Donald Trump has been bringing that up in his campaign.
Yeah, well, that has to do with state sovereignty. I certainly, as a Texan, would not like to be forced to sue my insurance company in Delaware. So I don't think that's the problem. I think, getting back to the licensing of the guild, what would be licensed for the guild was their ability to provide insurance, whether they self-insured by putting up an amount of capital adequate to cover their practice, or whether they bought insurance or they bought reinsurance. that would all be up to them, but there would be some board, some responsible agency that could say, okay, this guild is capable of providing insurance, either has it or they put up capital, whatever they've done, they would be certified, and then they could start licensing people to practice medicine within their guild. So the regulatory burden of the state would be just vastly reduced. It would still be there, but it wouldn't be the controlling factor anymore. So that's the difference.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything else about these topics on distributism and your economic ideas in your book that we didn't get to touch on?
Well, more than a few, but I would say to people, you know, learn how to do something useful for your neighbors, because I think not too long we're going to need people who are useful to each other. Learn how to grow food. Learn how to fix cars. Learn how to fix washing machines. I think we'll have to provide our own, locally, our own security services, our own water services. We'll have to figure out how to provide all the services now, which I think government will increasingly have a more and more difficult time providing. So neighbors will have to learn to get together and provide the things at the lowest possible level, and then to cooperate with other neighborhoods and trade and things like that to solve problems locally.
I was going to ask where that left academics, insurance companies, and lawyers.
Well, you see, there's a lot of professions that will have no meaning. You know, who's going to need a human resource manager? Who's going to need a marketing manager? Who's going to need all of these things that are prestige jobs now? But when you look at them, I mean, do we really need advertising professionals? You know, do they really add anything to the economy? Will we be able to afford, you know, a whole lot of things we consider essential now? But when you really think about them, they're all dead weight. They're all a dead weight loss. And I think we'll need, especially since we'll have a demographic problem by about 2030, 2040, I think we'll need all hands on deck and doing useful work.
Now, that demographic problem sounds like a topic we should have a different talk about. That's an interesting one.
John Madai, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
And thanks,
Robert,
Charles.
Robert, good talking to you.
Okay, gentlemen, and thank you very much.
That's all we have for
today's
show.
Look forward to talking to you
soon. Karen, we'll be back with you next time.
Okay.
Look forward to talking
to
you all again soon.
All right. Soon then. Bye.